Before this episode of your favorite 1517 podcast begins, we would like to thank our listeners for partnering with us during our annual podcast fundraiser. Together, listeners like you joined the 1517 Podcast Network in raising $68,000 in support of our podcasting efforts. This financial support maintains and builds the 1517 Podcast Network's ability to declare and defend the good news that you are forgiven and free on account of Christ alone in every episode. Starting this week, there's a new opportunity for listeners to partner with us and help us improve the podcasting experience that 1517 creates. We have built a survey for podcast listeners to give us feedback and give us an idea of what kind of shows they do listen to, what kind of things they would like to listen to, and help us hone in some of the habits that we have on our shows. If you would like to partner with us, you can take the survey now by following the link in the show notes below. You might also receive an email from 1517 in the coming weeks outlining ways to take this survey. Thank you for partnering with us. Enjoy this episode of your favorite 1517 show.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, you can check out all the other things that 1517 is doing. Make sure that you register for the new academies. You know, the academies are free, and there are new ones that you can take. You should probably take that Faith and Reason Academy with Adam Francisco, our buddy. If you want to get your faith and reason all figured out, figure out how this relationship works, figure out, are these things at war with each other? I mean, do you have to, like, just shut your brain off to, you know, to be a Christian? Is that what Chad and I are trying to get you to do as we go through the book of Esther? Are we trying to get you to not have any reason? I don't think so. So you can go find out all about that sort of stuff if you sign up for that academy. There's a link to it in the show notes. Chad, cat's out of the bag. We are starting a new book this episode, man. We get to go into the book of Esther, and this is a little bit different than what we've done thus far over the course of 8 years. As you move from one book to the next, there's at least, like, sort of, you know, some time might have passed, or might have been some kind of jump, or, you know, the language might be a little bit different, but you're sort of following a historical narrative. You're kind of following the timeline. You know, the books are roughly in order. You know, what you heard previously was, in fact, previous to what you are hearing now. And Esther is like a break from all that because there's so much that you don't know. And you kind of have this this one-off story just kind of thrown in here. You know, we've kind of completed the sort of the history of Israel according to what you get in the Old Testament. And before you're going to get into, you know, some prophets that were taking place during some of the stuff that we just read, you get this sort of strange book thrown in there. And it's not the only book like that. You know, Jonah's a little bit like that. Job's a little bit like that. I think those three kind of stand out as the books that are like, and now for something a little bit different, you know, and that's how it is.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of distinctions to the book of Esther. I mean, to begin with, it's one of only two biblical books that are named after a woman. Mm-hmm. Of course, we talked about Ruth a while back in connection with Judges, and now we have Esther, who, of course, is not the only main character. We have Mordecai, we have Haman, we have King Ahasuerus, also known as Xerxes the First by the Greeks. So we've got a lot of people going on active here. But yeah, Esther ends up being the heroine of the story. We'll get to her momentarily. Yeah, and the sequence is really out of sequence, the dates here, because so we covered Ezra, we just finished Nehemiah. And now we actually have to go back in time, because even though in our English ordering of the books, Esther falls after Nehemiah, the events described in the book actually precede not only Nehemiah, but also Ezra. So we're doing a little backwards move here. So she's going to become queen. in about 478 BC. So that's kind of, if you kind of get that in your head, 5th century, 478 BC. Now, that is two full decades before Ezra arrives in Jerusalem. And Ezra arrives in Jerusalem before Nehemiah arrives in Jerusalem to rebuild the walls. So maybe that kind of helps to position this. This is a little over a century after the Babylonian exile began. And of course, a few decades after the Jews were allowed to return from Babylon to Jerusalem by the Persians, you know, should they choose to. So we look at 478, that's when she's going to become queen. And we're going to right away be introduced to the king, who we usually say his name in English as Ahasuerus. I think that's a typical pronunciation that we give. But the Greeks called him Xerxes the First. Now, you all know Xerxes the First. Even though you might not know that you know Xerxes the First, you do know Xerxes the First, especially if you're a movie buff.
Yeah.
Seen.
Are we going to talk about some Spartans here?
Yeah, man. You gotta bring in the Spartans, because if you've seen the movie The 300, yeah, and you have seen a cinematic portrayal of this Persian king who had the audacity to invade Greece, he crossed over and he was in some pretty narrow straits that we know by the. What do we call them? The Gates of Fire?
Yeah.
Thermopylae. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty narrow place. Very narrow place. And before they could advance into the Greek mainland, they had to get through this place. And so famously, I mean, it's one of the great last stands of history, right?
Oh, yeah, man.
You got the 300 Spartans. Of course, you know the full story. It wasn't just them the entire time. There are a whole lot of others who were there. But they made the last stand led by the Spartan king.
They made it cost a lot.
Yes, right. It was a costly delay tactic, but you know, it was a delay tactic that at least helped the Greeks. Now the Persians, led by Xerxes, would eventually defeat the 300. I mean, if you've seen the movie, you know this already.
But only after one of the greatest lines ever uttered in all of human history.
There's a lot of great lines. Which one are you thinking of?
Well, when Xerxes says, "Throw down your weapons, and you can live," and the response is, "Come and take them." I mean, that's hardcore, man.
That's pretty hardcore. I thought you maybe were referring to
come and take them
the
is good.
Yeah, the threat that their arrows would darken the sun.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and the Spartans respond, "Well, then I guess we'll fight in the shade." There's some pretty great, that's why we refer to Spartan speech, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very short, pithy,
yep,
but packed with meaning. So yeah, that's our guy, Xerxes the First. We'll hear more about him just in the opening lines. We'll get to him, but we'll kind of flesh him out a little bit more in just a second. But so back to the timeline. Yeah, 478, that's when Esther's going to become queen. I think probably if there's anything that folks know about kind of the details of the book, not just kind of the overall message, but the details of the book, it's that Esther is the only book in the, not just the Old Testament, but the Bible, where God is not mentioned explicitly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no El, there's no Elohim, there's no Yahweh. I mean, the Song of Songs is close, but there is mention of Yah, which is a short form of Yahweh, in the Song of Songs. And of course, many times God sort of fades from the explicit narrative, but he's still mentioned. And I'm thinking in particular of the Joseph story, the Joseph novella, or whatever you want to call it. You know, where he's not nearly as kind of prominent in the Joseph story, but you still have this language of Joseph prospered because the Lord was with him. So it's still there. I mean, it's much more these providential ordering of events. You have the explicit nature of God's activities muted, let's say, but it's still, you know, he's still mentioned, not Nestor, no mention of God. Now, this creates problems for some folks throughout history. This is one of the books where there was quite a bit of back and forth debating as to its canonicity. So, you know, is it, did it belong? Did it not belong?
But the thing about Esther that's strange. I mean, so for Joseph, you still have this sort of promises made by God, and then, I mean, all you really need, you know, in the story of Joseph, to be like, okay, we're still thinking about the same thing, is lines like, and then God remembered Joseph, and then you bada boom, there you go. Like, you know what we're dealing with here, right?
Yeah.
Esther is not like that. There is no, and then God remembered Mordecai or whatever. This is not happening. To me, Esther always felt like if you were recording a history, right, and you were having these books written and stuff, there might be an instance where you said, hey, did you include the story of whatever it is, right? You're like, no, I didn't. That is a crazy story. I'm going to write like a little, and novella is like a good word. I'm going to write like a little book about that. That was a very, you know, interesting thing that happened. So we're going to write that down. And Esther feels like that to me, that it's sort of this really, I mean, it's a very interesting story.
Fascinating.
You read it.
Super entertaining.
It's super entertaining. Yeah. It's to me, Esther is as we've gone through the Old Testament, there's a lot of like shades of gray, and your good guys are all flawed, and your bad guys aren't like completely bad all the time, and like it's very nuanced, right? These characters. Esther's the good guy. There's just nothing you could argue about that. She's a good guy, and Haman's just terrible. I mean, like it's this good guy, bad guy, straight up. Like there's not ambiguous of what you're dealing with here. That's what it is. I don't know how you feel about it, but I read it and I'm like, Haman's a bad guy.
Oh yeah, yeah, no doubt about that. Yeah, I mean, he's like the ultimate bad guy in biblical history. Yeah. I mean, we've had a lot of bad guys, but some of them. I mean, even you think back to Pharaoh and the 10 plagues. I mean, there are instances in there where, for instance, he tells Moses, pray for me.
Yeah.
Haman's never going to say something like that. He's the ultimate bad guy. You know, he's dressed fully in black. There's not a shade of gray or white in his character. He's bad all the way through. Which, I mean, today leads to this is the background. We haven't said that yet, but so the Jewish festival of Purim or Purim, which is celebrated in March, which is a huge, it's like the most carnival like of all the Jewish festivals. I mean, it's a big party basically. It's like Halloween. People dress up. There's parties in the street. There's feasting. It's extremely festive atmosphere. And so when one of the things that always has to take place is they read the entire book of Esther. And anytime that Haman's name is mentioned, there's like noise that's made by the congregation to kind of blot out his name. That's the idea. Or booing or things like that go on. So he's the guy whose name is to be obliterated. Remember not to remember Haman's name is kind of the idea. So, this all leads to the celebration of a Purim or Purim, which we'll get to later in the book. That's kind of this is the historical background of that festival. But yeah, I mean, you got providence is one of the themes that's there. We'll, you know, see plenty of evidence of that where you have these, I'm doing air quotes, which you can't see, of course, because this is a podcast, but quote unquote coincidences. You know,
yeah.
There's a lot of those where, oh, it just so happens that coincidentally, the king couldn't sleep that night. And so he asked for the, you know, official records to be read. And it was there, lo and behold, he discovers that Mordecai once saved his life. And you have a lot of these reversals that take place. Eucatastrophes, as Tolkien would call them, where just when you think all hope is lost and the curtains are closing, bam, there's this complete reversal that takes place.
Yeah, there is
good
sort of,
and light wins.
Yeah, there is this sort of hidden God behind the scenes that is not ever stated, but it's not, you know, probably the most famous line from, and I know that you're like, hey, you guys can spend half the podcast talking about the book of Esther, or are you going to get into the book of Esther? But probably the most famous line from Esther, I think, is for such a time as this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now that seems like it has some divine punch behind it, right? Like, you are placed in this position for such a time as this. Well, who did the placing? And so there's like this implied thing that's happening where it's like, well, God has put you in this position for such a time as this. It doesn't say that, but it sort of, I think that's what you're supposed to take from that, right? This it goes to like that sort of providence stuff that even when you can't point to a Red Sea parting or manna falling from heaven or whatever it is, that you can say God is sort of active and you are in this place at this time because you're supposed to be, because God wills you to be. And so there is some sort of reading between the lines of what is going on there.
Yeah, and I think joined to that, this is kind of more on the other theme level. I mean, historically, this is a good case of illustrating through narrative how you live faithfully as a Jew in the Gentile diaspora. So I mean, you know, even if you have to do it surreptitiously, which is at least what Esther begins to do, you know, so you're very much a minority. You've been exiled. That's kind of the situation that you're in. But you're a Jew. So how do you live faithfully according to the Torah while surrounded by, you know, major and minor threats to your very existence? So how do you do that? Well, I mean, this is a great example of that. Esther is. Joseph was a great example of that too. I mean, both of these people, of course, rise to be right beside the king. Joseph as the vizier or whatever you want to call him. You know, basically he's the vice pharaoh, I suppose you could call him. And then Esther's the queen. So both of them rose to this place of prominence. Daniel's another example of that, where he's faithful, as along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're faithful, but they're also in these elevated positions of authority under these Gentile governments.
Apparently, the real secret is to be very attractive.
Oh, it helps. Yeah,
this is what we know about Joseph and Esther. Apparently, this you could work this to your advantage.
Yeah, that does happen on a daily basis still today.
I guess so.
Good looks fill in a lot of other gaps that people might have. Yeah, so. That's kind of part of the theme here. And I mean, it doesn't take much of a stretch to say, hey, you know, we're Christians and we're reading the book of Esther. So even though I think for most people listening to the podcast, we're not living under any kind of, you know, explicit persecution. We are living. I think we all admit we're all living in an increasingly less than Christian culture, I suppose you could say. So a lot of people compare it to, you know, we're now living in kind of a second century kind of climate. So as exiles in this world, how do we position ourselves to live faithfully, but also at the same time to live within that world and to work within that world and to serve within that world in a way that is also loving and merciful and wise, which is, speaking of that, this is wisdom kind of literature that in narrative form exemplifies, illustrates a lot of the stuff you'll see in Proverbs and other wisdom literature. Let me say one more thing before we jump into the text, and that is you may have heard that Esther is the only book that from the Old Testament not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've heard hints, you know, that people suggest there are maybe some possibilities, but the overall consensus is that, yeah, it's not. So what does that mean? Does it mean that the people at Qumran rejected the festival of Purim? Possibly. Does it mean that because Esther is such a relatively small book, it just wasn't found among the scrolls? Yes, possibly. So you can't read too much into the absence of Esther from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then one more thing, for those who might have a Bible that's not your typical Protestant Bible, maybe it's a Catholic Bible, or maybe it's what is it called, the Jerusalem Bible, something that includes the Apocrypha in it. Well, this is, Esther is a famous example of where the Septuagint, that's a Greek translation, differs substantially from the Hebrew, and especially in the inclusion of a whole bunch of stuff that's not found in the Hebrew. So there's six major additions to the Hebrew text found in the Septuagint, a total of 107 verses that are inserted into the Greek version of Esther. And a lot of these are what you might expect. They're kind of, do we have a verb for this? Religionizing, I suppose, making it more, making explicit what is more implicit in the book so that God's name is mentioned. There's prayers that are recorded in the Septuagint editions. So there's kind of a fleshing out of stuff that's between the lines in the Hebrew the Septuagint.
It's like the Hobbit devotional. That all of a sudden, like I've seen this. Like, so you can buy this this version of this companion, because they can't change the text. So you can buy this companion where you can dig out all the spiritual meanings of the Hobbit as you read along in this companion volume. And suddenly, I went from thinking that God wasn't really mentioned in this book at all to this being the most explicitly Christian volume of all time. That's the sort of thing that it feels like, where it's like, hey, let's just really do the work here and show you just how explicitly religious this whole thing is.
Yeah, that's kind of what happens in the Septuagint version of Esther. It's sort of a more preachy text. We might say, yeah, let's help the reader out in case they happen to miss the God element here. We're gonna make sure it's unmissable in this version. So anyway, that's about 20 minutes of some intro material on Esther, kind of get it positioned chronologically, and a little bit of the theme stuff going on there. And with all that being said, we'll jump in here and see how far we get in this first episode. Starting out here with Esther 1:1, we already meet the name of our king. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, The Ahasuerus, who did what? He reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. While he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. Now, I'll stop there. That's the first four verses. So one of the things that becomes obvious and we're going to see more of this in the next, I don't know, probably three or four verses. One of the things that becomes obvious in this first section is that the author of Esther, whoever that was, we don't know, but the author of Esther wants to make sure that you don't miss. It's pretty hard to miss the fact that this king thinks that he is it. I've been to some pretty big parties, and you know, some parties last more than a few hours, but 6 months. This lunar calendar, you got like, you know, about 30 days in the month. It's 180 days. We're gonna have a 6 month party. It's like the party of the millennium. And he's showing off, basically. That's the whole purpose of this. And we'll see more of this way exaggerated language in the verses that are coming up here too. But one of the impressions that we are intended to receive from these opening verses is that this guy is beyond lavishly rich, beyond powerful, beyond, you know, everything that you might think a monarch is going to have. He's got it all. He's all powerful. He's all rich. He's all generous and, you know, providing this long, lavish party for all these officials and whatnot. And I don't give too much away up front, but one of the things that will become obvious is that this guy who seems to control the entire world can't even get his wife to bend to his will, as we will be introduced to the queen in just a few minutes. So there's some poking fun at King Ahasuerus as well. So I mentioned earlier, this is Xerxes. who reigned from 486 to 465. He was assassinated in 465. So he's the son of Darius the Great, and then Darius's wife, who was a daughter of Cyrus the Great. So he's probably best known for that Greek invasion that we've already talked about in 480. He ended up, after the Battle of Thermopylae, he ended up burning Athens, and then was eventually defeated and had to tuck tail and head back to the homeland. But not without quite a bit of destruction in Greece.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is that it's so obvious that this is Xerxes, that so if you're reading this in the NIV, it just says Xerxes.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yeah, it says right. it. Well, I mean, that's how certain they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never come across any scholar who thinks it's anybody but Xerxes. And every time I say his name, I see that image of him from the 300. It's like burned in my mind. He's on that huge throne and looking very, very strange in the way that he was all done up. But yeah, that's the guy. So he's from India to, well, most will translate this as Ethiopia. The Hebrew there is Kush, which is referring to Upper Egypt. Doesn't necessarily align with modern day Ethiopia, but anyway, that's usually how it's translated. He comes to power. He's got to squash some rebellions. You know, as typically happened in the ancient world, when you have a new king, a lot of the far flung provinces want to rebel, maybe establish your independence again. So he had to squash some rebellions in Egypt and whatnot, and then settle down. He was firmly in power now when this is taking place. Now, chronologically, this is right before his invasion of Greece. So some people think that one of the reasons that he gave this huge party was to try and get everybody together to convince him, hey, you know what we should do? We should invade Greece. So maybe that was the purpose of getting the army of Persian Medes and nobles and governors of the provinces and everybody together, because this was the time to consolidate power, to get a consensus together that, hey, this is what we should do. We should invade Greece. So anyway, that's what's going on here in the background. They're in Susa, which is not the only, but one of the capitals of this area. If you check out the commentary, some people will say, wait a minute, 127 provinces, you know, the most that's ever listed is something like 31 of these satrapies. Probably what's going on here is these provinces, which are referred to as a medina in Hebrew, are talking about smaller administrative subdivisions and not the satrapies that are usually referred to. But either way, there's the overall impression here is of a worldwide power. So he gets them all together and has this long party for 6 months. Some hyperbole going on there, no doubt. The verse 5 says, when these days were completed, so we get past this bigger party, then the king gives another party. So he gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for only 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. I guess the locals, you know, they kind of got gypped. They only got a 7 day instead of a 6 day, a 6 month party. And verse 6 says, verse 6 is providing some color to this. Again, this is to make sure you understand the opulence of the party and the lavish nature of the king's palace. We have white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, to silver rods and marble pillars. And we have couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Man, is there more they could have added to that? That's you almost have to like pause at every phrase and get this visual of extreme wealth that's being displayed here. I mean, does that describe your bedroom and your living room? Or
definitely. It also sounds unsustainable. So you're like, how long can you keep this going?
Right. Yeah. Pouring a lot of money into this. So that's the decorations. What about the drinks? Well, they got drinks too. And you're not drinking out of your solo cups. Nope, you're being served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds. And royal wine was lavished according to, literally according to the hand of the king, which ESV translates correctly as the bounty of the king. Probably it's just talking about basically his generosity. So liberally according to the hand of the king. Verse 8 is a little bit difficult to translate. Your versions do this in different sorts of ways, but ESV has drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired.
So this, NIV so this, has, this just sounds like an open bar.
Pretty much, yeah. NIV has, by the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink in his own way. But the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. Yeah, I mean, the was it the New Living Translation? Living Translation? Whatever the paraphrase would be. And the king commanded that there be an open bar.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. So you want to drink a little bit? Fine. You want to drink a lot? Fine. So after all of this, you know, very verbose, very, very lavish display and description of all these things going on for the dudes, for the guys, kind of keep in mind all this banqueting was for the men. We have one verse and one verse only that describes another feast that was going on. And this is described in a very conservative sort of way, no doubt to contrast with what we've already been covering. Queen Vashti, we'll come back to her in just a second, also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. So we're going to find out more about her in just a minute. Herodotus, who was the Greek theologian, gives a different name for this queen, Amestris. So people explain that different ways. Some people say, well, there's a contradiction here, but it need not be that. Maybe she went by different names, or, you know, maybe there were multiple queens. Probably there were. So the queen that we have here in the Book of Esther is named Vashti. So she gives this feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. So all of this is kind of a setup for what's going to happen here with a problem that I already alluded to earlier. And this is going to begin with verse 10. On the seventh day, so this is after the second feast when we've had a seven-day open bar. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was literally good with wine, which is translated to use as merry with wine, he's drunk.
That's what it would seem like. That's,
yeah, this is the Bible's way of saying the dude was sloshed. Yeah. His heart was merry with wine. Yeah, he's intoxicated. Seventh day, this is the last day of the feast, so he's been over-consuming for quite a while. What does he do? He's going to give a command to seven of his palace officials, which is usually rendered as eunuch. This can refer to not to actually to guys who have been castrated and are serving, for instance, in the harem, but it can also be used to refer to just officials. So maybe they were actual eunuchs. Maybe this is just a technical term for those who are chief officials. Either way, we'll go with eunuchs. Seven eunuchs, and we have their names here, which I won't read to you. But he commands these seven eunuchs while he's drunk. These seven eunuchs who served in his presence to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown. Now, we know from inscriptions, we know from monuments that this isn't like we think of as a crown, you know, like you think kind of European kings and queens, but this was like a tall, stiff cap that had jewels on it. So it was a royal headdress, maybe is a better way to translate this. But anyway, she's supposed to come before the king with her royal headdress, with her royal crown. Why? In order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. So that's the command. I mean, this is the ruler of the world. Not the president of the United States, not whoever it might be that you would compare it to in modern terms. This guy rules from India down to Ethiopia. He's got 127 provinces. He has enough money and enough power, enough organization, enough wine, enough food to throw a 6-month party, followed by another 7-day party. The dude has it all. He seems to be, you know, God on earth, as it were. And so when he commands these 7 eunuchs, he's talking about pomp and circumstance. You know, he could have just sent one guy, says, hey, go get the queen. It's 7. He's got to get 7 eunuchs. So all of this. And then verse 12 says, Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. I like her already.
Well, I mean, okay, let me paint this in like a modern picture. Of course, this isn't a modern thing. But I dare you to try this, where you get like blitz drunk and then send 7 people to go tell your wife to doll herself up so that you can like show her off to all your friends and see how that goes for you.
Yeah, report back to us, please.
Like, you don't go ask her. You say, you send 7 people to be like, hey, babe, I need you to come out here, make look cute. Yeah. Make sure you look cute. I'm going to show you off a little bit.
Do your hair, makeup, put on your hottest outfit that you have, and come out here. I'm going to let everybody ogle you.
Yeah, my drunk friends want to check you out. Like that's yeah. It's not like the most shocking thing in the world that she wasn't like real into this.
Yeah, so you know, kudos to the queen. I like her already. She's going to suffer as a result of her refusal.
Now, there is a big difference between the dear listener, trying to pull this off and his wife refusing, which I'm sure his wife refuses, and this guy trying to pull it off. This guy has a lot more power than anyone listening to this.
Yes, I mean, this is the first time in the book that we have somebody, in this case the queen, somebody standing up against what is wrong and for what is right.
Yeah.
And we're going to see more examples of that. And you know, and it was a risky move. She suffered. We don't know. I mean, we know to some extent what she suffered. She's replaced. But, you know, this could have gone a lot of different ways. But she does what's right and suffers the consequences. And we're going to have other instances where people stand up for what is right and at least place themselves at risk. So
I do think it's safe to say that you and I are told no more times every day than this guy has been told no in his life.
Yeah, that's pretty safe assessment. Yeah, can you imagine who says no to the guy who rules from India to Ethiopia, who has all power, you know, all riches, 127 provinces? Well, I'll tell you who: his wife. That's who says no. The queen says no to him. Makes you wonder too if like this has happened before.
Yeah,
you know, she's like, no, I'm done. It's hard for me to believe that this is the first time in this king's life where he's totally drunk and he's like, I'm gonna show off my wife.
Yeah,
yeah. So, yeah, anyway,
so maybe this is the last time, but
the last row.
He doesn't love it. I mean, so you can see in verse. And in the second half of verse 12, I mean, he became enraged and his anger burned within him. So, like, and this sounds like, of course, this isn't a guy that likes being told no, but, like, this is embarrassing, too.
Oh, very embarrassing. I mean, I'm thinking of it's in no way fully analogous. But, you know, you think of when Herod was having his birthday party, you know, he's got all the people there, no doubt showing off, and, he says to his stepdaughter, yeah, just whatever you want, up to half the kingdom I'm going to give to you. And then the urging of her mom, she says, well, give me here on a platter the head of John the Baptist. And because of his oath, because of his guest, even though he didn't really want to, that's what he did. So here you have, you know, another powerful figure, of course, much, much more powerful than Herod was. And he's been refused. And so, yeah, his ego is bruised. His own wife has said no to him. So, he's going to become enraged. His anger is going to burn within him. And we'll see. We're about out of time here, so we'll see in verse 13 to following what they do as a result. Now, what they do as a result, I find to be humorous, because just to kind of give you a feel for it now, that she's not going to, the penalty is she is not going to see the king again. She's probably like, oh, that really hurts. So in other words, the penalty is I get to do what I wanted to do in the first place, not see his face again.
Yeah.
It ends up being to her advantage.
Well, we didn't get far, but we have set, I mean, this does set the stage for, because you're like, where's Esther? Well, she's coming. This is directly yeah. connected.
Yeah, this is kind of like Nehemiah. You have to get a while, or Ezra. You got to wait, get a ways into Ezra before you actually meet Ezra. You got to get a ways into Esther before you actually meet her. But yeah, that sets the stage for, it kind of gives you a feel for some of the background and some of the themes are going to be looking for. It's going to be a fun book. It's one of those books that is a great reminder that it's fine to laugh when you're studying the Bible, because there's humor and there's rage and there's everything else on the emotional spectrum that's kind of woven into this book. So it's going to be fun.
Awesome. All right. Well, we will no doubt meet Esther next episode, and hopefully you guys will join us then. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.